Welcome to Rebalancing Act. We are Kieran and Leslie Ann, two lawyers and friends. We know that climate change is here and that we have to solve it. So every episode we come together and we talk about how we will get there. In today's episode, I have a great interview with Pete Richardson from Manifest Climate. I'm looking forward for you all to be able to listen today. Here's Pete.
All right, so we're recording. Thank you so much for agreeing to the interview today, Pete. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm excited to be here. It's a beautiful day here in downtown Toronto, and excited to have a chat about all things climate change.
It is. The good and the bad.
The good and the bad, exactly. And there's a lot of good, and there's also some bad. Some would say a lot of bad.
Why don't you tell me a little bit? So Pete works at Manifest Climate, which I know has worn a few hats as a company over the years, but is currently doing a bunch of things, including climate disclosure. So it'd be really interesting to hear about your own path to law. And then I guess also your own path from law now to your current position at Manifest Climate as a climate strategist.
So as a kid, I never actually knew what I wanted to do. So a lot of people, in fact, our co-founder, Laura Zizzo, had a very clear vision she wanted to work in the environment and climate from a young age. I never really had that. Like, I was always concerned about the environment, but I didn't have this burning desire to do great things with respect to climate because I just didn't know enough. In fact, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I liked history. I liked understanding how structures and it worked and how people sort of organized themselves. And so that kind of took me down a path towards law, because I loved reading about old cases and I loved reading about, you know, how government and policy trickles down to law, which trickles down to everyday life. And so that took me to Oxford, where I did my undergrad in jurisprudence, which is really the philosophy of law, but is a law degree as you would imagine in the typical sense. And after that, I said, well, you know, I'm not quite ready to join the workforce yet. I need to do some more studying. So I did a master's in international law with a kind of an environmental focus, because I'd always had a bit of an environmental bent anyway. From there, okay, well, I now have this sort of legal background. Which law firm particularly is doing the best work on climate? And as I was working my way, you know, around the interview process, I was thinking, goodness, where can I go? And it actually took me to Toronto, bizarrely, where I worked for a very short period of time with Jutta Brené at the University of Toronto on the Kyoto Protocol and some research around that. And it was just such a fabulous experience. And that really solidified and cemented my interest in kind of the climate, everything climate. And so I looked around, and at the time, my alma mater, Baker McKenzie, was just doing fabulous work on climate-related law. And so I joined Baker McKenzie in 2006 and worked as you would imagine in various different departments, but ultimately ended up doing a lot of carbon trading. And that took me to different places, different things. So I worked for a climate fund at one point. I worked in Indonesia, worked in Australia. And then I sort of morphed a little bit into sort of renewable energy. And worked in the US in Chicago, spent quite a bit of time doing tax equity work, financing wind projects, solar projects in the US, and also in the Middle East.
You know, Leslie Ann, I really appreciate what Pete says just about having a longer career path, because I almost felt like law school sometimes when I was there. Because, I mean, a law degree is supposed to give you opportunity. And it almost felt to me sometimes like the amount and the type of jobs that I could do actually narrowed. So it's really nice to see, even within the realm of law, and then, you know, applying your legal skills outside of the realm of law, there really are so many different possibilities that we can do, and careers are long.
Totally. I think I'm actually really lucky in the sense that I came into law school not confident that I wanted to be a lawyer, but just thought I could do cool stuff with it.
And so it really was a pretty circuitous route before I arrived eventually into Toronto, where I am headed up the major projects practice at Baker, most recently as a partner. And then, you know, transaction by transaction, which were just fabulous work, I was looking around and thinking, goodness, what else might there be out there? This is kind of around the COVID time. as well, because you know, everything sort of shut down. And again, to be frank, I was having discussions with my wife about, you know, what our respective careers would look like in for the next few years. And I looked, and COVID has been termed the Great Resignation, not unreasonably. And I was part of that. And at the time, I was thinking, I need a new direction. And so when I was looking for that new direction, I'd known Laura Zizzo for some time from her environmental consultancy work. And then I was independently put in touch with her co-founder, Jeremy Grevin, through a mutual contact. And this mutual contact said, hey, look, these two are getting together and they're going to try and match up or sync up sort of consultancy with software. And I thought to myself, well, goodness, that's interesting, because that would move the needle. If we could just get information that folks needed out into to the wider world, well, that really is really interesting. So that took me to a series of conversations with the two founders, and that took me to where I am now as a climate strategist and also sort of head of services here at Manifest Climate, working with a bunch of different companies to try and figure out what good looks like in terms of climate disclosures, as you mentioned, but also more generally in terms of climate maturity.
That's great. And I think it really echoes what I guess, you know, I read on LinkedIn about the Great Resignation, and it really seems like the driving forces behind it to some extent are, you know, everything is always partially driven by salaries and money, as it should be, but also it seems like many other more diffuse factors have been playing into career changes, including, it seems for a lot of people, actually, there is these other intangible factors. There's meaning, there's contribution, there's culture, there's all of these other factors that go into what makes the day-to-day of a job, you know, really enjoyable and motivating. And I think it makes sense to me that your own decision was sort of motivated by these ideas of what can I contribute in this exciting new space.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, when you think about what people are looking for, there's a really interesting new book actually out by Mark Carney called Value, and then in parentheses, F, close parentheses, so values. And it really looks at kind of the distinction between pricing things and valuing things. And that kind of, you know, you can kind of think back to the Oscar Wilde quote, which says, to know the price of everything but the value of nothing. There's been a huge amount of work pricing things, but the value proposition, the true sort of externality about what people are really interested in doing and becoming mission driven, I think COVID really has sparked something there. And it's pretty exciting, actually.
Definitely. I also didn't grow up wanting to be, quote unquote, an environmentalist, and I wouldn't necessarily call myself that now. But my search for what I wanted to be doing with my career was really driven by lighting on key issues that society hasn't solved yet. And climate wasn't actually the first one that I arrived at in law school. I was really interested in privacy law. I do think privacy is still a really interesting and unsolved issue that we are facing, but then I actually turned to learning a little bit more about Indigenous issues and Indigenous and Aboriginal law in Canada, and that sort of led me to climate now. It has been really interesting to see all of these people that I knew growing up. They seem to have actually had somewhat of the same path. Like when I look at what people are doing today, so many more of them than I expected are actually doing sustainability related things. And I would assume, you know, without talking to them, that a lot of them have had a similar path of thinking, looking around them in the world and wondering, where can I provide value? Where are we needing value? And where are we needing people to, you know, do some of this innovative work and necessary work?
It's all of these types of issues, you know, the privacy issues that you mentioned, you know, Indigenous rights. You can add to that list sort of poverty. You can add to that list women's rights. You can add to that list climate. These are the really big issues that really are so challenging because they involve so many different actors, so many different constituent groups. We are drawn towards these really big issues. And I think the key thing for anyone listening is to figure out, okay, these are the big issues of our time. How do we approach these issues in a way that is really, really constructive?
I think that's a really interesting segue into my next question for you today, which is, you know, as someone who's been immersed in the environmental community for many decades, I'm curious to hear about what your take on the content and its goals has changed over time, because I know that there has been an evolution in some ways, to my impression, a broadening and a diversifying of the movement?
Our position with respect to any particular issue is driven by how long our memory is. And that's our memory I use in a collective sense. So we're so used to news cycles right now being kind of a cadence of rolling news. But the reality is, to get a true picture, you need to change the focus or focal point and look at weekly news or decadal news. And in fact, we really should look, you know, even before that. So when you think about some of the real pioneers of the environmental movement, you know, someone like Rachel Carson, who memorably and historically wrote Silent Spring, which I think really triggered a lot of the environmental movement in certainly the United States, but also further afield. When you look at from those kind of beginnings all the way through to where we are today, you know, you look at something like COP26 before the summit started, there were big sort of signs saying this is not working, we're not moving fast enough. And all of that is true. But when you look at where we've come from, we really have come a huge way. Thinking can adjust and change very, very dramatically over time. And even though it is accurate to say we are not moving fast enough, it is also, I believe, accurate to say that there has been a fundamental shift in terms of climate awareness and climate maturity. We're not certainly where we need to be, but I think right now I actually have a lot of hope.
You know, I too do have a lot of hope. There's so much data about climate change. There's so many ways of measuring the problem that I think it is like very easy to get overwhelmed. And I think, you know, sometimes if you do choose certain narratives and metrics of, you know, ways of presenting the issue, it does seem very hopeless. I do think there's like been an interesting jump from we need to ignore climate change to like it's too late. Like, it seems like somehow for some people, that's been the trajectory that they didn't want to think about it because they didn't know how to solve it or they didn't know how to contribute. And oh, looks, we left it too late. This is it. And I think finding the space in between those two concepts is where the hope is. And like, hope is such a more powerful driver and motivator than fear. Like, you couldn't do your job every day if you were only driven by fear and anger. Like, that's just not how motivation works.
Oh, it's a terrible approach. And the reason why it's a terrible approach is that you can only run away from a bear for so long. Eventually you get tired. And at some point you actually have to turn around and face the bear and say, you know what? We can address the issue. And in fact, you know, nobody goes to the Olympics out of fear alone. They go because they want to achieve, they want to do well for their country, or they want to, you know, just see how far they can push themselves. And I think there is a huge movement with respect to, you know, this culture of fear and this culture of despair that is actually counterproductive. Now, having said that, it's really important to win hearts and minds. And one of the ways that you can do, and this goes back to the constituency piece that I mentioned earlier, is there are different constituencies whose job effectively is to make sure that we are paying attention. And those constituencies typically, you know, they're personified by activists, you know, but not just them, but also others. Their job, if you like, is to make sure that we're not losing the fear. Just to your point, you can't act on fear alone. You actually have to act with inspiration to see what the benefits are potentially of this new future. And by the way, when I think of new future, there is, and this is probably going on a bit of a tangent, but I think we should go there. You know, there are lots of different futures that one can imagine that are driven off a climate agenda and a poverty agenda and, women's rights, which, by the way, is one of the most important things that we can possibly do to address climate. You know, if we start addressing poverty and start addressing women's rights, you know, that actually around the world is one of the key markers to that is a precursor to actually environmentalism. So, I mean, when we talked earlier about, you know, these big problems, sort of societal problems, when you think about, you know, what should someone coming into the space work on, it doesn't have to be just around climate data. By no means. It can touch on everything, data around poverty or women's rights or whatever it might be. Like, there's just a huge amount of levers that we can pull to end up in the right place. And transparency with respect to, you know, what you and I are doing, or what companies are doing, what governments are doing, is critical for accountability. And that's really where the focus and actually the evolution of Manifest Climate emerged from.
So I think Manifest is a really cool company. It's one that I've kind of had my eye on for a little while, ever since Laura came to U of T to talk about what she did with her law degree. And like, they really found their niche in climate disclosures and helping businesses understand climate risk and disclose that to stakeholders and build mechanisms around that key transparency that I think is going to be such an important part of our conversations around climate change going forward.
It is. If you don't know the problem or really understand it, and I would argue that no one single person can fully know the problem in the most objective way because there's too much data. But I think just some amount of like education about even basic things that we think, you know, are known and aren't, can go a really long way. And it's great to see organizations out there actually doing that work.
And I just love their intersections between like policy and law and tech. They've put out some really interesting research papers and position papers on different climate issues as well. I think it's a really interesting almost incubator for a lot of climate thought happening in Toronto right now.
Love it. Love some full, you know, some hatching of climate insights happening. I'm extending this metaphor.
Love it.
And that is, you know, it is interesting because that is what Pete did say was really at the core of Manifest Climate's business, is the idea of transparency about the risks of climate change and also about the attendant rewards that we can have, both financial and otherwise, by actually tackling this problem.
So I'll morph then into kind of, you know, what we're doing here at Manifest Climate, which is, and maybe just a bit of history actually. So it finds its origins. So the founder, Laura Zizzo, actually was part of one of the first sort of climate law firms in Canada. This is way back in sort of 2009. That morphed into a consultancy, more of a consultancy practice in 2015 that became multidisciplinary to involve engineers, accountants, as well as lawyers and others. And that lasted, you know, for a good 5 years until sort of Laura and team spotted a gap in the market and decided to pivot. And the pivot was associated with Laura's co-founder, Jeremy Greven, who came in as a product or software entrepreneur to try to figure out what good looks like with respect to a climate response. And to answer the question, you know, what would happen if you put on climate tinted glasses to decision making? So what we do is kind of to add that climate lens on what we hope is every decision. And we do that in three ways. Firstly, we try and get people speaking a common language with respect to climate. So that's kind of, you know, for want of a better word, sort of e-learning and teaching. Secondly, we try and get people understanding what others are doing. And you can kind of paraphrase that as market intelligence. And then thirdly, we try and get people to start changing their behavior. And that's all around sort of the climate maturity. And our focus is all of those sort of three modules is driven around particular frameworks and standards that are out there in the market and that are designed to support companies and organizations to go through that that process from A, understanding what the issue is about, B, you know, seeing what others are doing, and then C, actually changing their own behavior. And the way we're doing that, we're trying to take the best of data and the best of consultancy and put them together. So to paraphrase, I think it was a Nike ad that said, you know, power is nothing without control. Sort of one of the views we have is, you know, data is nothing without insight. So on a spectrum of companies that just provide pure data, I mean, that's okay, but unless you actually have the ability to sift through that data, filter out the noise, and actually put that into sort of decision useful information, you don't get very far at all. And so our software is designed to twin the best of data and the best of sort of climate insight gleaned over a number of years to actually provide folks with meaningful things that they can do to actually start changing behaviors.
That's a very quote unquote teach a man to fish kind of approach. And I think that that's so crucial, because at the end of the day, the thing that the climate movement needs above all else is for people to be on board, people to be educated, people to be able to understand the media, understand the economics of, you know, whatever they're doing from a climate lens, and be able to act with that climate lens in mind in a really impactful way. And like, more than anything, I think if you are equipping people to be able to make positive climate decisions for themselves, like that is maybe one of the most powerful tools I think that we can have in actually getting people on board for climate solutions and getting those solutions out there.
The other thing I'd mention actually is, it is teach a man to fish. And when you are fishing, I'm just going to try and stretch this analogy a bit. There are only so many levers that you need, right? You need a fishing rod, you need some fishing line, you need a lure, and perhaps you need a boat. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
What we try and do is give folks the tools to actually go out and fish. It's not just say, this is how you fish. It's also, here are the levers that you can pull to actually fish correctly, right? Because one of the big challenges with climate is that people look at it and go, oh my goodness, this is such a big issue. I can't do anything about this. It's too big for me. And the reality is that there are only a limited number of levers that any one of us, either individually or as companies or as organizations or that, there is a finite number of levers. And those are frankly known levers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not this big sort of unknowable thing. Actually, if you want to, and I'll personalize this, you know, if you want to reduce your carbon footprint in Canada with respect to the home that you own, if you are lucky enough to own a home, then there are only a certain number of things that you can do. You can switch out your heating for something that is low carbon. You can improve your energy efficiency. You can adjust your consumption patterns. Again, there's a nuance there. People think they have to reorder their entire lives to actually get to where we need to go to. But if you look at something like the International Energy Agency's roadmap, only about 4 or 5% of the reductions needed come from consumer behavioral change with respect to the activities they're undertaking. But more than 50% comes from consumer behavioral change as to the choices that they make with respect to purchasing decisions. What that really means is, you know, you can still do the things that you like doing, but the methods that you use to actually do those things, in this case, my example, to heat your house, have to change. And that's a really difficult thing. It's counter to a lot of what people think. And it's also critical to understand when mm-hmm. you think about the lead times for making the changes that we need. But if I'm trying to heat my house and I want to switch that out for a low carbon option, well, any decision that I make today, because of a concept called committed emissions, will have profound impacts for how long does a furnace last? 5 years, 10 years, who knows?
I hope longer than 5 years.
Yeah, I think my last one only did. But my point is that this is a complex problem, but it's not necessarily a complicated problem, right? There's only a certain number of levers you can pull. And so what we try and do is to try and showcase, simplify, and sort of daylight the levers that any particular organization can start pulling to actually have a meaningful impact.
Funny, like, all, you know, there's been a lot of media right now about high natural gas prices, and I guess what the difference that the additional knowledge that you're talking about would make is the difference of including the idea of a heat pump in that conversation, whereas I find it's like not there right now, which, you know, a heat pump is a low carbon way to produce your energy to heat your home, and like it's a little bit more complicated than that. But even, you know, it's the difference between having this one specific pervasive media narrative of the gas crisis, we need to produce more gas, we need to do all of these things, and being like, oh, actually, there's a different lever that you can pull that changes the conversation a bit.
Absolutely. The challenge with that is to say, okay, well, fine, you know, and by the way, this is from a real life example, you know, middle of winter, furnace breaks down, And you ask the question, okay, well, what do we replace it with? Do we replace it with gas or should we look for a heat pump? I mean, good luck trying to find a good competition with respect to those things at this stage. I mean, it's critical when we think about, oh, in theory, it's one thing to say, yeah, we should be all switching out for heat pumps, and we should be, you know, but often you'll get a response. When you think about the response, it's like, okay, well, for the places where, you know, heat pumps are the ideal low carbon solution, do we have the supporting ecosystem to actually sell heat pumps for a competitive price, B, service those heat pumps for a competitive price, and C, get information about those heat pumps into the market that is actually accurate and that actually tells folks, you know, gives folks the right information such that, you know, you don't just typically get the response which says, well, they're not as good, you know, or, you know, different thing. I mean, the challenge is all of these issues come up at the worst possible time.
Totally.
They will come in the middle of winter. They will come at, you know, when your baby is asleep and you've figured out, oh my goodness, my heating's gone off.
Yeah.
Those conditions are not conducive to make good purchasing, good climate positive purchasing decisions, for sure.
No, they definitely aren't. And you can't be the person saying, oh, your house or your apartment is freezing cold. You should think about doing some research into this. I just want to be warm again. I just want my life to stop being like this.
Exactly.
It does show, you know, really like the individual action is great, but I think when a critical mass of people are educated such that those resources, that planning is available out there, that makes these solutions so much more powerful. For people that want to be a conscious consumer, how do you sort of evaluate some of the sources of news that you get?
So I think it's important to understanding that kind of the background to greenwashing. So greenwashing kind of grew out of whitewashing, right? And whitewashing has been around since at least the 1800s. The archetype is sort of covering up a scandal by kind of a functory investigation or a biased presentation of data. And you know, you can put that in literature terms by, you know, George Orwell, you know, Animal Farm, where Napoleon tries to sort of whitewash history by deleting characters from the minds of other animals. So whitewashing has a hugely pejorative meaning. And so does greenwashing, actually. I mean, that the origins of that was, I think, sort of Jay Westerveld's essay on the hotel practice at the time of saying, please don't, if you don't want us to reuse towels or wash towels on a daily basis, please sort of leave them on hanging rather than on the floor, and that way we'll save the environment, right? This was back in 1986.
Wait, so that's not how it works?
Well, I'm not sure which one, whether you leave the towel on the rack or you put it, I think if you put it in the bathtub, it gets rewashed.
I've never heard this before, but I am familiar with like the little cards that you get and stuff in hotels.
Right. And the implication there is that, you know, if you don't get your towels rewashed, then, you know, we'll save the environment. I mean, that's archetypal greenwashing. Yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, it's good. It's good to not have to rewash things, and that's important. But why are the hotels doing this? Were they doing it purely on environmental grounds, or were they doing it on profitability grounds? So Westerveld was kind of arguing that this is actually on profit grounds, and to give it an environmental face is whitewashing, or as Jay put it, greenwashing. So that is, and again, so it has this sort of connotation. The reality is that actual fibbing, you know, or lying or fraud, you know, making an environmental claim that is just wrong is actually, well, I don't know if it's rare, but it's rarer than some of the other sins. Other sins being, you know, very, very vague claims. So product packaging, you know, where this is sustainable. Okay, how? Or failing to disclose sort of hidden trade-offs that are, you know, example, palm oil. There are very real. The palm oil has a green attribute to it, but you have to pay a lot of attention to key environmental issues that are associated with that, or to having environmentally disastrous consequences. All of those things, right? There's a pejorative nature to all of them. There's also a different flavor of greenwashing, and this has come out pretty recently, actually, which is around green wishing. Green wishing being not pejorative in nature, but being making well-intentioned statements, but that ultimately don't move the needle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the folks that advocate green wishing this is a pretty challenging space to be, because it no longer is about, you know, making just bad statements. It is actually making good statements, but being unable to either carry them through or unable to actually move the needle. And some examples of those greenwashing that have been put out there, which frankly, I'm not sure I agree with, you know, carbon offsets or even science-based targets, right? There is these big long-term targets. My view on this is that both of those things have a critical role to play, mm-hmm. but in the wrong hands, they can be guilty of greenwashing.
Definitely. I like that. I haven't heard that before, but I'm definitely going to slip that into the old vocabulary now. So thank you. Thank you. That's great.
There you go.
I have one more question for you. And I know that you attended COP26 very recently. A lot of people read about it in the newspaper. You know, there's some level of understanding, or I mean, even lack of understanding on like, what is COP? You know, what's it stand for? I would say a lot of people don't know too much about it. And it would be really great to hear about what it was like.
COP26, so in Glasgow this year, stands for the Conference of the Parties. So it's the 26th Conference of the Parties of the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. But it's actually a lot more than that. And in fact, there's two aspects that are really have three features to them each. So that's a weird way of saying COP26 is a shorthand for three different negotiation tracks. You have a negotiation around the UNFCCC, then you have a meeting of the parties of the Kyoto Protocol, then you have a meeting of the parties of the Paris Agreement. Now, of course, the people may or may not know this, but the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement are effectively daughter international treaties of the UNFCCC. But that really matters because those three different tracks play a big role in terms of the output from the negotiation. So to a lot of listeners, that's probably, well, this sounds pretty bureaucratic, particularly because many of the parties to UNFCCC, Kyoto and Paris are the same. You know, there's a huge overlap, right? There's you can count them, you know, a handful of that don't overlap. Mm-hmm. But it is really important because this is international law, and international law is by its nature built on trust. And so you need to kind of do, for want of a better phrase, do everything by the book. And that creates kind of this fairly bureaucratic, often frustrating, but ultimately very well-intentioned sort of scenario ecosystem where you've got kind of got lots of different interest groups all under one roof that are playing their negotiations through three different tracks.
Okay. Kieran, is it just me, or is this giving you major Model UN vibes? Like, it can't be me, right?
Spoken from one Model UN veteran to the next. My Model UN experience happened in, like, when I was 20 and 21, which is kind of hilarious in retrospect. I'm like, is that too young or too old to be doing this?
Wild. My Model UN experience was, like, Model UN adjacent, because I was a volunteer first responder at McGill, and so we would be tasked with like being present. And I'm not gonna lie, being in Montreal and having a bunch of American students experience an 18 aged drinking age for the first time while Model UNing, wild. Wild times. I saw things.
You've got those three different tracks. You've got, you know, you've got UNFCCC, you've got Kyoto, you've got Paris, but you also have a tale of three COPs, whereby you've got the intergovernmental discussion, which is, you know, looking at all of those big three issues. Then you've kind of got kind of the business world, the financial world, the business world, etc. And then you've also got, you know, what is called generally sort of civil society, and which within that group as well, you've kind of got, you know, activists and that kind of thing. And the question that often comes out is, okay, well, was it good? Was COP good?
That is, I think people either have the idea that it succeeded or it failed.
Yeah. Well, two things on that. Number one, it depends on the constituent group that you represent. And number two, it will depend, and we talked right at the top of the call around, you know, the cadence of the role in news cycle. Ultimately, the success or failure of this COP will be measured in history. If Paris was intent, COP was meant to be, COP26 in Glasgow was meant to be the summit for action. And I would say, number one, there were a huge number of shifts that had lots of airtime. Things around methane, things around deforestation, things around coal and finance, etc. So you can put that, kind of chalk that up into the success camp. Into the failure camp, you can chalk up things like, you know, the fact that the pledges and the action that has been taken is not sufficient to address the pace and scale to address climate change. And there was also, I mentioned how important trust is to international law. There was some lack of trust with respect to things like loss and damage. But on the whole, I would say that it was a success in the sense that it compressed our timeline. So historically, and lots of listeners will know, you know, net zero by 2050 has kind of become table stakes with respect to any kind of discussion around this issue. At Glasgow, that timeline was effectively compressed, not necessarily moving the needle from net zero by 2050, but certainly changing the narrative around, okay, well, what needs to happen by 2030? So a lot of the things I mentioned, methane, deforestation, et cetera, actually that all has to happen, or the commitments made at COP by 2030. And that changes the narrative hugely, because historically, one of the big issues, the two big issues with the climate response is, number one, I'm too small to make a difference. And number two, that this is going to happen way beyond my lifetime. So I think, and I hope we've addressed today, at least in part, number one, which is to say there are a limited number of levers that one can pull. And if all of us pull enough of the levers, then we'll make a difference. So that's response to point one. Response to point two is, well, this is no longer about a long-term view. This has to happen in the next, effectively, 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is a problem because of something called the tragedy of the commons. More recently, there's been a tragedy, or Mark Carney has come up with this, or came up with this concept called the tragedy of the horizon, which is similar to the tragedy of the commons in the sense that, you know, if you don't regulate the commons, then the commons will be destroyed. Mark Carney's view of the future was, if you do not regulate the future, or you do not good eye to the future, then you will have a tragedy of the horizon. Exhaust all the natural resources, or you'll do, you know, bad things today, which will ultimately have disastrous consequences. Both of those narratives, the tragedy of the commons and the tragedy of the horizon, I would argue have now been not addressed by any stretch, but certainly put into the limelight, right? Because it is no longer the point that every executive in a big business or in government will no longer be around for them to be held accountable for the decisions that they make today. Because if you say, okay, well, a lot of these pledges and these issues have to be resolved by 2030, we cannot say, and this goes back to the greenwashing piece as well, we are now down to timeframes where people will be measured within the next decade. And that is within the careers of almost everyone, certainly everyone listening to this call. Executives can no longer say, okay, well, this is a future issue. This is really a now issue. It always has been a now issue, by the way, from an environmental perspective. It's just that in now, and again, this goes back to the big shifts that I've seen in my career, it is also a now issue from an economic perspective.
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you say that you talk about the future, because I know that it's an Indigenous learning, really, to think about being a good ancestor, thinking about taking care of generations, seven generations ahead. And it's a type of thinking that I personally haven't been as familiar with, but is really powerful and really resonates. And I think it ties into the idea of taking care of and being a steward of the land instead of, you know, just in a more consumptive frame of mind. And I think, you know, there'll be many lenses. There'll be an Indigenous lens. There'll be Mark Carney's lens, you know, there. But I think really becoming familiar and comfortable with this idea of we're here for a short while and other people will be here after this, and we want them to have a good life too. And we want to take care of the spaces that we have for them. Is just, I mean, it's great because it really connects us to the past and to the future too, and is really crucial to, I think, taking these decisions that need to be made now, but are going to have really positive impacts for the future.
There's a lovely story from Formula One that I want to bring up.
I am so curious to hear what Formula One anecdote you're going to bring up. So, even though I have yet to get my G2 driver's license, which is a personal point of embarrassment for myself, I have gotten very into the Formula One world, and I really enjoy watching it. And I found out that Pete, you know, as also someone from the UK, also is a big fan of Formula One. So I think that that would be a great place to close out the podcast interview.
So Formula One, I mean, it's, you know, you think, well, is there a worse possible industry for an environmental or sort of climate person involved in climate to enjoy? You know, something which basically goes around tracks emitting carbon for fun. That's not what I want to focus on today. Even though, by the way, there are very good and positive benefits for putting a series of ultra smart, ultra competitive people together in the same room and getting to race around circuits. Things like, by way of example, anti-lock brakes or power steering or traction control from racing series, because that's, you know, they're pushing the needle. That's not what I'm going to concentrate on. This is just a little story, an anecdote to finish then on about COVID, actually. So in COVID, as you would imagine, all of the Formula One teams were effectively shut down, and a lot of the staff were put onto furlough, and that was a problem, obviously, you know. But rather than just sort of sit there and say, oh, we're on furlough, we're pretty unhappy about this, the call came from the government to these engineers, these designers, these manufacturers, to say, look, I think we can use your help. I think that you have the right skill set to help us out with ventilators for addressing, you know, the very, very many people who are now in ICU, and that for whom we do not have enough ventilators. And at the time, call it, you know, the UK was producing, you know, 100 ventilators per year. These are really difficult things to build. And so what the government did said, hey, would you mind, Formula One teams, clubbing together and figuring out whether you can find a way to make and manufacture ventilators in a way that is quick enough to respond to this crisis? And to a person, said, yeah, we'll do this. We want to contribute. And within, again, paraphrasing, but within 10 weeks, they had 10x the number of ventilators. Why? Because you had a huge number of very smart, very competitive people who wanted to make a difference. And so they accelerated tenfold the ability of the UK manufacturing ability to create and manufacture ventilators, simply by using folks that would otherwise be, frankly, being, you know, idle in the working sense. And for me, that is a telling anecdote, because it tells two things. Number one, it says that people really want to help, and if you give them the right conditions to help, they can do that. And number two, if you give people, smart people, the right conditions to be competitive, then they will come up with things and solutions that can make a difference in an incredibly short space of time. And for me, that is, although it's taken from the COVID world, that is a microcosm for what we need to do. We need to get folks who want to make a difference, which is to say almost everyone, and we need to get folks who are smart and competitive to pull in a direction and compete to actually achieve the solutions we want to achieve. And I think more and more that is happening. And I think more and more we should be pushing for that. And there are lots of different ways we can do that. And I'm happy to come back on and chat about some of them in the future.
There you go. I know there's infinite things to hear your thoughts about, but I really appreciated that anecdote. It's just reaffirming my belief and really enjoying Formula One. I'm looking forward to the upcoming race. And I'm feeling very inspired by this conversation. So Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Pete.
It's my pleasure. It's been fun.
I'm so glad.
Kieran, this was such a great interview. I am low-key jealous I did not get to hang out with Pete, but I know you felt that way about my Turtles interview, and I feel like this was your Turtles, and I love that for you. And I love that everyone got to listen to this.
Especially because, you know, we really slid in there. We stuck a wheel in there with the Formula One reference at the end, which I very much enjoyed.
Ugh, I love that for you.
That's all for today. If you want more Rebalancing Act in your life, you can check us out at Rebalancing Act on LinkedIn, Rebalancing Act on Instagram, Rebalancing Act _ on Twitter, and as always, on our website, rebalancingact.ca. We are going to be taking a break for the holidays, but we will be back with some exciting new content about infrastructure in 2022. Can't believe it's 2022. Almost coming up on us. It's crazy. We'll see you folks then.